So it's a pleasure to introduce our next speaker, who is Reverend Dr. Justin Tompkins. He has degrees in chemistry and then moving through into theology. And he's going to continue our conversation on artificial intelligence by talking on living with aspiration in an age of human enhancement. Justin.
Thanks, Emerson. It's really good to be with you this morning and to continue the theme. This is a poster from an exhibition that some of you may have seen back in 2012 that the Wellcome Collection, what was the Wellcome Institute, put on, exploring human enhancement. And one of the things that I think is fascinating about this poster is the way that the glasses, the hearing aid, and the false teeth all portray putting right something that is a problem, rather than going beyond that to anything which is superhuman. And I think that at the heart of human enhancement, there's this distinction between using medicine to heal what is broken, as opposed to going beyond and taking what is well and making it better or enhanced or improved in some ways. And as I started to read about this whole subject about 10 years ago now, I came across the fact that Ritalin was being prescribed to children in schools who were finding it difficult to concentrate, but it was also getting into the hands of university students and others who were using it when they were cramming for finals as a way of taking their already great capacity to study and take it to another level. And when I mentioned this to my brother-in-law, who was a student in Boston at the time, he said, yeah, I know a number of friends who are using drugs like these as they prepare for their studying. So how can we try and look at what human enhancement means? This is one definition, and it's from this book back in 2009 by Savulescu and Bostrom, saying that the use of medicine, technology, and techniques to improve the capacities of people beyond what we would consider normal or healthy. If I were going to come up with the definition myself, I'd want to distinguish between healing and going beyond therapy. But not everybody wants to do that. And Savulescu and Bostrom, I think, would want to blur that line between the two, because there are all sorts of motivations within this whole field. Bostrom is a Swedish philosopher who was one of the co-founders of the World Transhumanist Association, now Humanity Plus. And transhumanists are those who seek to bring about posthumans. Posthumans being those who have got vastly greater capacities than any current humans. Posthumans as those who we might not recognise as humans because they'd got such greater capacity than us. Savulescu, an Australian philosopher, he did his PhD in Australia under the supervision of ethicist Peter Singer, who has a view of personhood very different to that John was talking about earlier on. Peter Singer would talk about personhood in terms of consciousness and capacity and ability, and as such he'd argue that animals such as dolphins have got greater rights to be treated with respect and to be protected than brain-damaged humans. So there are perspectives within those who are advocating human enhancement which contrast quite distinctly with those that would come out of a Christian tradition. Where are we now in terms of some of the things that we could point to today that might be edging towards transhumanism, going beyond therapy to something different? Many of you will have heard reports over the summer about the number of people in Sweden having these microchips implanted in their hand, just between the thumb and the forefinger. But thousands of Swedes have now had these small implants placed in their hand, the same sorts of implants that have been used to track animals or packages over the last decade or so. And they're being used in Sweden in place of rail cards, rail tickets to open doors, as a credit card. Interesting, the first person to have a chip implanted in that sort of way wasn't Swedish, but was British. The scientist Kevin Warwick, a number of years ago, he's now the deputy vice-chancellor at Coventry University. At the time, he was professor of cybernetics at Reading, and he used that first implant to turn on lights, to open doors, to call a lift. When he got near his computer in the morning, the computer would say good morning to him as it sensed his presence getting close. And as part of that whole experiment, later on, his wife had an implant within her own hand temporarily so that he could squeeze his hand and she would feel a reaction in her own hand. Well, what else is going on at the moment that takes us beyond therapy? One thing that has been in the news over the last few years, transcranial direct current stimulation, a number of computer gamers finding that if they wear a headset which will send electric current to stimulate the brain directly through these sort of electrodes on a headband, then their capacity to play a computer game is enhanced. Back in 2016, there were reports of the American military using these sorts of headsets to get greater capacity out of US military personnel. A journalist called Sally Addy tried one of these devices, and she likened it to having an excellent cup of coffee without caffeine jiggers. She said she was more herself. She said that she was calmer, she was sharper, she had less fear and less doubt, she was more confident. So there are small kind of glimpses of things emerging at the moment that we might put into this category. But I think that transhumanism, human enhancement, is really about what's the vision of the future which is being set out before us. And I want to offer three aspects of that vision. And I think key to that vision is aging. It's about genetic engineering of children, and it's about merging ourselves with machines in various ways. First of all, aging. You may recognise Aubrey de Grey with this wonderful beard. Aubrey de Grey started off as a computer scientist through his wife, who is a gerontologist. He got involved in the study of ageing. He wrote a book on that back in 1999. And on the basis of that book and the research behind it, Cambridge University awarded him a PhD in biology. Aubrey de Grey believes that there are those alive today who will live to be 1,000 years old. And he's calling people to fund work into ending aging. He feels that as classic cars can be kept on the road through replacing and upgrading parts, that a human body can be treated in the same way. Lee Silver is a molecular biologist from Princeton in the States, wrote this book, Remaking Eden, about 20 years ago now. And he talks about an imagined future in which there are two groups of people, the naturals and the gen-rich, the genetically enriched. And he imagines a future in which those two will become separate species. And he says that will come about not through any kind of government legislation, not through any companies agreeing together what the future will look like, but through two things, through parents who are seeking to have a child of their own, and the desires of those parents being allied to increasing technology. And he says that reproductive technology is already at a state that it's in allowing increasing freedom around having a child of our own. And he says that as each parent makes decisions for the best of their child, we will get towards the sort of future that he envisages. The third strand that I want to name from Ray Kurzweil, whose 2005 book, The Singularity Is Near, got me interested in this whole area initially. Again, Kurzweil comes from a computer background. He made money through voice recognition software and through musical synthesizers. And he is convinced that a singularity is approaching, and he estimates that will arrive sometime in the mid-2040s, beyond which point we won't be able to distinguish between the mechanical and the biological. He says that our understanding of biology and of machines is growing so fast, and he predicts that will continue to grow exponentially, as Moore's law says that technology has been growing over the last number of decades. And Kurzweil says that we will get to the stage where, as humans, we will have so many implants, and that as technology, machines involve so much, but biological merged onto that, that we won't be able to distinguish between the two. He talks about the world waking up beyond that point, and so God emerging from the world as consciousness explodes at this sort of a time. So three core visions. Are they realistic? How do they relate to what's going on today? Let's have a look at those three strands and see if there are any clues in what's going on at the moment. First of all, aging. You may recognise this picture of Jean Calment, a French woman who died at the age of 122 and 164 days back in the year 1997. The three oldest verified people within the world are all women. The third oldest died back in April this year, a Japanese woman, at the age of 117 years. And the oldest person alive today is understood to be 115 years, also in Japan. Now, as I got on the train this morning, I saw that somebody had written in a kind of grimy window of the station, E equals MC squared. And as some of those scientific bits of information are picked up and bandied around in society, so I think the Bible can be. And this is an image which was sent around the internet as a meme when Jean Calment reached 121 years of age back in 1996, quoting and mocking this verse in Genesis 6. And the Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years." I think when we think about aging, this verse is sometimes quoted. My sense is that this verse is talking about the period between this prophecy and the flood 120 years later. A number of scholars would say that's what this verse is pointing towards. It's not saying that nobody will ever live beyond 120 years. The key thing that I take to back that up is that there are many points later on in Genesis where people are described as having reached more than 120 years beyond the flood. These two scientists are American researchers who had a bet back in the year 2000 in response to a comment that Stephen on the left had made, that he felt that by the year 2000 there was already somebody alive at that point who would reach 150 years of age. Jay on the right, working within the same field, said, I don't believe that's true. And the two of them bet one another $150 each to be put into a trust fund and to be released in the year 2150 to a descendant of one of these two on the basis of who proved to be right. Nature reported back in 2016 that they'd put a further $150 each into this fund, which at that point in 2016 had reached $1,275. And Nature pointed out that if it continued to increase at the same kind of rate, that it would be worth over $200 million by the time we get to the year 2150. So researchers in the field have got different views about aging. This is a Nature article from earlier this year, where on the basis of looking at, you can see 3,836 people aged 105 and over. This model was set up to say that the annual risk of death plateaus at those who are above age 105, and it seems to level off at about 50%. So however old one is above the age of 105, there's about a 50% chance of making it for another 12 months. Now, still, that kind of 50% every year doesn't predict vastly long lifespans beyond that point. But those researchers who produced this paper in Nature says that it does point to the fact that there's not an upper level. This is relating to genetic engineering of children and Lee Silver. Just a couple of things that we might point to in relation to that. August of 2017, Nature reported the successful correction of a germline mutation in a human embryo that would have led to heart disease, now using CRISPR technology. Now, that was never intended that embryo would be implanted in a mother and grow to be a child, but it was another step towards that sort of possible technology. We have had reports over the last few years about children born with three parents with different mitochondria from the mother, from two different mothers, one with DNA from the mitochondria and the other within the rest of the genome. Testing of unborn children continues to give the possibility for terminating a pregnancy because of fetal abnormalities. That may change the way that we see children being born with different diseases. I read that 4 out of 1,000 recognised pregnancies at the moment are terminated in the second trimester due to fetal abnormalities. It's not difficult to imagine that that might change if the ability to test for further fetal abnormalities increases. What about Kurzweil's thinking about uploading ourselves to a computer system as he imagines us being able to do from the mid-2040s? Just before I mention this book, John mentioned digital inheritance earlier on. We may not be at the point of being able to upload ourselves into a computer system, but we are increasingly living online lives so that we're thinking about what happens to that social media inheritance beyond the point at which we die. I've loved reading this book by this American journalist who was living in Australia at the time that she wrote this, back in 2010. And as a single mum, she decided that she and her three teenage children were going to go screen-free for 6 months. And so at home, she would set aside her smartphone for those 6 months. At home, they wouldn't watch television. The computer games were sent down the road to a friend. And she's written this book about the experience, the profound experience for all four of them of living in that way for those 6 months. Within the book, she mentions the connection between ourselves and the devices that we use within this digital age, and tells a story of a woman who had a car accident. And as paramedics were coming to help her after the accident, her first cry for help to the paramedics was, "Where's my BlackBerry?" Recognizing the kind of the age that BlackBerries are less common now, but she wanted the device. It made me think that when I myself had a very minor car accident a few years back, my glasses came off my face, and despite the fact that I was bleeding at the time, the first thing that I wanted to do was to feel around for my glasses to work out what can I see, how can I make sense of what's going on. Why are these visions important? That those futuristic visions of Kurzweil uploading himself into a computer system, De Grey of people living to be 1,000, Lee Silver with humanity splitting off into two separate species, they're so far away from what's going on at the moment that we may or may not think that what's going on now is likely to lead to there. But why are these visions worth exploring? I think because we know as scientists that what we measure has an impact upon what we observe as happening. My mum gave my two children these fitness monitors a few weeks ago, and I've seen how their behaviour has changed as they've worn these monitors, counting their steps, and they're competing with one another to reach the most number of steps by the end of the day. These visions for the future affect the world that we live in, whether or not we end up at the place that those who are aspiring to these visions would hope to get to. What sort of theological engagement has been carried out in this area? Just a few things here. Michael Burdett wrote the Grove booklet introducing the subject. Robert Song has done a lot of work on this area, including this book looking at subject in relation to genetics. Celia Dean Drummond has drawn others together, drawing upon virtue ethics, encouraging others to write on the subject. Brent Waters has looked at this in relation to postmodernism. In my own book, which I wrote really for the congregation at the church where I did my curacy and stayed on as associate vicar, I really wanted to say that we have a whole wealth of theology that illuminates this area. And I'm going to name three of those areas very briefly. One on eschatology. And again, John referred to some of this earlier on. Does our hope for the future, the new heaven and the new earth, do we understand that to be brought about by our own capacity and ability through our deployment of technology? Or do we trust in God outworking his plans and purposes? What about the two great commandments, to love God and to love our neighbour? Loving God, I would say, relates to understanding his awesome creativity, recognising that we're works of art made by a master craftsman, not flawed models in need of an upgrade. Well, what about love of neighbour? So some of you may recognise this image from the movie Elysium. Science fiction often gives us a realm within which to explore some of the ethics of this subject. Within Elysium, a futuristic context portrays the poor living on Earth and the wealthy living on a space station orbiting the Earth. What does that say about our connectedness to one another and our ability to love our neighbour? Some of you may have come across Susan Greenfield's book. Susan Greenfield used to be director of the Royal Institute. And as a neuroscientist, she imagines a future. And within that, she imagines a digital butler who will meet our needs in such diverse ways that she imagines, will we want to be with a flesh and blood neighbour at that stage? Whatever we think about the reality of any of those predictions, I want to end with three final slides as a way of thinking about how do we live with aspiration in a context of human enhancement? And what does it mean to think about becoming better in that context? First of all, this book by Brian Christian, who was one of the humans involved in the Loebner Prize, the Turing test that has been carried on each year for the last two or three decades, trying to find the computer that is most able to fool a human judge that it's actually human. And each year, there are humans who are communicating alongside the software. And journalist Brian Christian was one of the humans. And as there's a prize for the most human computer, so there's a prize for the most human. And Brian Christensen got it at that year in 2009. And as he reflected on that experience afterwards, he said there will come a time very soon when the software programs which are participating in this test will be more able than real humans to convince some of the judges that they are human. And at that point, we face a choice. We can either give up and say that's another area of humanity that we'll withdraw from and we'll leave to the machines, or we can say, okay, machines may have got better at yet another activity which humans have traditionally been the only people able to participate in, but we will use that as a challenge to become more human, more fully alive. Gary Kasparov, reflecting on being beaten by Deep Blue and thinking about artificial intelligence, says much the same thing. And he says, too, that the challenge to us is to be more human, more fully alive. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, is reported to have been asked by students, what's the first bit of evidence that you've discovered of human civilization? And she's supposed to have answered that it was a healed human femur, thigh bone. She said that before modern medicine, it would have taken 6 weeks for a thigh bone to have healed to the point where a person was able to fend for themselves again. And a healed human thigh bone was a sign that first person had been cared for in community during the time that they were sick. She said that's the first sign of human civilization. All of which I think takes us to this final slide from Philippians 2 and points us towards the one who was the most human, the most fully alive, who in Paul's words emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form, humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And it points us towards the image of God, as John mentioned, and what it is together for us to be the body of Christ. Thank you.